What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I speak with Doug Drexler. Doug Drexler is a visual effects artist, designer, illustrator, and makeup artist who has collaborated with such talents as Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, James Caan, Meryl Streep, and Warren Beatty. He began his career in the entertainment industry, working for makeup artist Dick Smith on such films as The Hunger and Starman. He also contributed to Three Men and a Little Lady, The Cotton Club, and Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy earned Drexler an Oscar, as well as the British Academy Award and the Saturn Award for his special makeup effects on characters such as Big Boy Caprice, played by Pacino, and Mumbles, played by Hoffman. Two Emmy nominations in the same field followed for 3 years working on Star Trek The Next Generation, where he performed such tasks as aging Captain Picard for The Inner Light. In this interview, we discussed a lot. We discuss what drove him into visual effects, his passion for it. We certainly discuss his time with Dick Tracy and partnering up with John Caglione Jr., the experience of winning an Oscar and what that meant to him and what he did afterwards. And now I give you Doug Drexler. Okay, I'm here with Doug Drexler. Doug, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
Hey, thank you for having me, and hey to everybody who may be listening.
Yes, sir. No, I'm excited to have you on. Before we get into everything about, you know, your career, the movies, makeup, etc., please tell our listeners briefly sort of who you are and what you do.
Well, I work in film industry, motion pictures and television. For the past 30 years, probably, it's been television. I kind of found my home in television, you know. Well, I first should say that I've kind of moved around a lot. You know, some people get into the business and they're makeup artists and they do that for 42 years or something and that's it. And as a matter of fact, almost everyone, only very few exceptions, everyone gets a career and they stay in it, you know. But I don't know what it was about me, but it was like every 10 years or so, I would see that same. If you're in a television show like Star Trek, which I've worked on Star Trek, it's got to be like 22 years now. But there was a long period of time in the entire span of the 90s and into the, 2004. If you're on a television show that is long-lived and long-lived like Star Trek is, you're working with the same people for, you know, a decade or more. There's all these departments, visual effects department, wardrobe, you know, the mill where they build stuff. You get to know everybody and you get to be family. So it's like, if I'm working in the art department, which I did for about 10 years,
sure,
you get to know the visual effects guys. And you hit it off, you know, you share a sense of humor. And I'm like, hey, do you think you ever might meet somebody over there? You already know me. You know, I mean, there's some things I'm going to have to learn. So it's like, I started as a makeup artist. And I don't mean beauty makeup and stuff like that. I never could do that. You know, I hate to admit this, but for makeup artists to admit this, there's some really beautiful girls on these shows. And I always found the great female beauty to be very intimidating. You know, I would rather just do aliens and monsters and stuff like that instead of trying to make, you know, a beautiful woman look even more beautiful, you know?
Interesting.
So I did prosthetic makeup for that long, effects makeup. But then I slid over. I was on Star Trek and I got to know the art department guys. We had a lot in common. And I ended up sliding sideways into the art department, originally a little bit on Next Generation and then all through Deep Space Nine. And of course, while I was doing that, you know, I went from doing graphic design in the art department to sliding sideways again into an illustrator, you know, and went into the illustrators, you know, Art Directors Guild. And while I was doing that, visual effects guys would come up to the art department and we got along great. And then one day I just said, hey, so I ended up going from makeup, graphic design, illustrator, visual effects, which I did visual effects for about 11 years, I guess, some on Star Trek, and then a guy named Gary Hutzel, who used to work on Deep Space Nine, went to do visual effects on the Edward James Olmos Battlestar Galactica series. And that was some groundbreaking stuff, you know, and he was trying to get me for quite a while. And I was on Enterprise and I couldn't just leave because a Star Trek show could go for 7 years. But he sure had on me. And one day we noticed people coming into the Enterprise art department that we never saw before with tape measures and measuring the room and stuff. And we're going, uh-oh. Come in your office and start measuring things. So it turned out that Paramount had plans to cancel the show after 4 seasons. So I had been on the show for God knows how many years. And when we finally got the word, I was driving home thinking, man, I'll probably never work again because it's a very nomadic business. You never know where your next job is going to come from.
Sure.
And I'm driving home thinking I'll never work again. And I get home and Dorothy, my wife, meets me at the door and says, Gary Hutzel left a message on the machine. And I'm like, oh my God, he's going to ask me to come to Battlestar Galactica on the same day I got laid off on Star Trek. And called him. And he says, I heard about Enterprise. I'm like, yeah. And he says, but you know what? Every cloud has a silver lining. What happened? I went on to Battlestar Galactica.
The same day.
The same day.
That's extraordinary.
The thing about, I went after I did my decade of visual effects, I went back to art because if you do visual effects, sometimes you're working all through the night on shots because if you're doing visual effects, you're at the end of the pipeline,
the
entire show. So every person who's late, it collects onto you.
Interesting.
Well, so that's really some hard work. You're like sleeping on the floor. And it was the same with makeup. If you're doing makeup on stage, you got to get there maybe 3-4 hours before the crew even gets there to start your makeup to have that person ready in time to go in front of the camera. Then at the end of the day, you're taking the makeup off them. You're going to be there for a few hours after the crew leaves.
Wow.
So I ended up in my old age going back to the art department because almost always you go home around 5 o'clock, you know, because for one thing, you're not doing effects stuff, which is like performance art. You don't know how it's going to go. And you're not doing makeup, which is unpredictable. You know, you're not attached to the set, in other words. And so the idea of going home at 5 o'clock was very appealing after. So, I mean, you know, my career, 42 years now, you know.
Wow. That's awesome. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it. Winding the clock back a little bit, I'm very curious. When did you, perhaps phrase it this way, when did you find your passion for visual effects and how did you foster it when you were younger?
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 60s and there wasn't a lot of science fiction on television, really. You know, like you could count all the shows on one hand. There were even that many. You know?
Sure.
Now there's so much of it. So those kind of shows always appealed to me because I was kind of, before the word geek happened, I was a geeky kid, you know? And I didn't play any sports. I couldn't catch, you know, if like a ball came at me, we were doing softball in high school, I'd watch it go right by my glove and hit me in the head. I couldn't do any of that stuff. But I loved reading science fiction as a kid. And I loved science fiction movies and things like that. And I kind of enjoyed that because most people didn't do that sort of thing. It was considered to be stupid stuff. You know, I mean, to my father, comic books were for idiots. You know, as a matter of fact, during the McCarthy era, comic books were being accused of being communist.
Really?
Oh, yeah, when there were trials and, you know, the publisher of Mad Magazine, William M. Gaines, was put on the stand and it was crazy. So there was a stigma attached to this sort of stuff in the 60s. And I liked not being where everybody else was. They could be over there playing baseball and hockey and basketball, and I'm over here doing this. They don't care about it. And as a matter of fact, they're probably going to make fun of me for it. But I liked that little club that I was in. And so I started, you know, there were a couple of books that were really instrumental in making me realize what goes on behind the scene. And like if you're watching Star Trek, the original Star Trek, you realize that beyond the frame of the screen, there's a whole other world. There's grips and guys smoking cigars. And oh, back then, anyway, not anymore. But there was a whole other world where the kind of the drama that was going on was even crazier than what was going on in the show, in the episode, you know? And I learned that because Star Trek really affected my life. Gene Roddenberry's wife, he was the creator of Star Trek, Majel Barrett, started a company. Originally, I think it was called Star Trek Enterprises. And anyone who wrote them a fan letter got a like one sheet thing where you could buy, you know, emblems and, you know, script pages and crazy, and film clips. You could get a package of film clips. Majel was taking, she'd go down to editorial when they were cutting the original Star Trek, and the scraps, the leftover stuff, was going into bags.
Wow.
Probably going to throw it out. And she just collected all that stuff up and had a couple of people make snipping clips. And you could buy, you know, like for a buck or something, like 7 clips, space shots, you know?
Huh.
You'd get an actual piece of the film, 35 millimeter, and you'd look at it and you'd see it on the side, there'd be a squiggly thing going on. You're like, what's that? And you start to research, of course, you don't have the internet, so you're looking in books and stuff, that was the sound. And then there'd be a guy with this clapboard with stuff written on it in a scene that your heroes, you've seen it before, but here's this, you know, guy smoking a cigar with glasses on top of his head, like ready to, and what's that about? So that piqued my interest. And also, they started selling actual scripts for the show. Like a script was about $7 at the time. And that was amazing because they were having the print shop on Paramount print them out. They were as real as whatever was on the stage. And so now I had actual scripts that I was looking at. And I just became utterly fascinated by that because not only was it this far removed from those knuckleheads over there, this is a whole nother level they know nothing about. And they don't even care. That's great, you know? That's exciting to me. So a book came out, I think in 1967, called The Making of Star Trek by Stephen E. Whitfield. It's still one of the best books on producing a television show out there. And it was the story of the original series with interviews with Roddenberry and Robert H. Justman, the producer on the show. And it was full of production memos and set plans and outlines for stories. And it was like a blueprint of how they made a show. And I'm like 12 or 13 years old, you know, and that was like mind-blowing. And here I am at 12 or 13 years old reading all of this stuff. I remember my father said to me, if you put half as much time into your schoolwork as you do in this stupid television show, you'd be okay. And of course, he got to see me work here. He got to see me get an Oscar for Dick Tracy.
Yes.
And after that, he was always he would tell people, you know, if Doug's not sure what to do about something, he comes to me and asks me my opinion. And whatever I say is the opposite.
I think if I hadn't pushed Doug, he never would have made it. One of those, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That stupid television show. Actually, I mean, I know he liked Star Trek. Star Trek was an amazing show. I mean, especially at the time, people don't realize how groundbreaking it was. I mean, right now, we look at the Bridge of the Enterprise on the original series, and we don't think anything of it. It's just a science fiction set with people pressing buttons. But in 1966, you had a black woman in a position of authority.
Yep.
You had a Scotsman. You had a Russian, who were our enemies. You had a Japanese helmsman. Only how many years before we were fighting the Japanese? You know, almost everything else you saw on television in the 60s portrayed them as being our foes.
Right.
And, you know, they all had thick accents and stuff. Now, you have George Takei, who's very, you know, he speaks beautifully and, you know, defies. It was a microcosm of the earth. People, when they watch it now, they don't know because they've gotten used to it. But at the time, it was startling for people. A woman, you know, as an officer on the bridge of a ship. Originally, Roddenberry had the first officer of the ship was Major Barrett, a woman. It was unheard of that a woman would be on the bridge of a, you know, a naval vessel or something.
Right.
So you have to put it in perspective, just how far ahead the show was,
yeah,
you know, as far as social thinking and stuff like that.
Well, and there was that one episode that, you know, William Shatner kisses an alien woman.
Michelle Nichols.
It wasn't Michelle Nichols.
Referred to as the first interracial kiss.
Right.
On television.
Right.
I mean, you don't actually ever see their lips lock. They do this thing where they turn.
No, it's funny because I remember we were shown that way back in the day. I must have been maybe fifth, sixth grade, right? And our teacher, you know, showed us this clip and all of us, we were wondering why we were even watching this, you know, but like back in the day, that was a huge deal. And now we fast forward to, you know, fifth graders are watching it and not even understanding like
what
the relevance is.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
That's progress.
It's really amazing. You know, I was a literate kid. I read lots and lots of science fiction, but I became obsessed with Star Trek because in the attention to detail, I could tell that whoever was in charge of this show was a science fiction fan like me. I saw that they were, once I started getting scripts and I had the making of Star Trek, I saw that they had Harlan Ellison as a writer. They had Theodore Sturgeon as a writer. You know, I mean, we're talking guys who write science fiction novels are well known for being science fiction authors. That blew my mind too. to see that. Of course, I know Harlan had done stuff on The Outer Limits, which was a little earlier than Star Trek. I mean, he's quite a character. Do you know who Harlan Ellison is?
You know, I've heard the name. I can't say I'm familiar.
He's the science fiction author who is very combative and very opinionated. And if you're going to deal with Harlan, you're probably going to be in hot water a lot of the time. And actually, I think Isaac Asimov says that Harlan Ellison was the only organism he'd ever met who natural environment was boiling water. And so if you had him writing a script on a show, you were probably going to have some problems down the line because you can't rewrite Harlan without him losing his shit. You know?
Really?
Yeah. And Gene didn't take that into account. He did, I guess, you know, it's not like now I could go on the internet and see Harlan Ellison and see him all through his life and what he was like and be prepared. But there's really no way Gene could know that Harlan was as combative as he was. And Gene ended up, Harlan did things that there were no way. Like, for instance, they had Scotty selling these things called jewels of sound that were like a drug, but it was, you know, ultrasonic. And Gene was like, he's got my Scotty selling drugs. You know, so it was like, eventually, Gene had to rewrite it pretty heavily to make it work for the show. And, you know, the original Harlan Ellison script is really great. But I have to say that I think that Gene's script was a great improvement in many ways, the way he used his own characters, you know. But you should check out Harlan Ellison. There's a documentary on Amazon. I think it's called Dreams with Sharp Teeth.
That's a great name.
It's Harlan, you know, towards the end of his life. And the only person I've ever seen that Harlan Ellison was in love with was Robin Williams. He and Robin Williams were friends. And there's video of Williams at his house on the tape, you know. Huh. And Robin sees a whole wall of old typewriters that he has in storage. And he just bursts out laughing. He goes, in Harlan Ellison, this is like an ammo dump. But it's a moment where, you know, Harlan, who's so enamored of Robin, hugs him and says, I want to have your children. And Robin says, to have one of mine, I'll bring him over later. But you should watch it. It's really wonderful. And he was quite a character. Not everybody knows about Harlan Ellison, but he was very influential. And, you know, when I lived in New York, I used to do readings. And you could go and he would read his stories. And you get to actually spend time with Harlan Ellison. Cool. I knew all about him, so I never did anything to make him bad.
No, thanks, Doug. I appreciate that. So, you know, pressing forward, I'd love to know, when did you first meet John Caglione Jr.?
John. John, you know, it was like, I was just thinking about this morning, the people in my life who, you know, helped make me who I am. And I see them as gods and goddesses.
I do that too.
Influence the direction. I got interested in makeup. And that's the story too. But I ended up getting my first job with a guy named Dick Smith. Now, I was living in Brooklyn. Dick's shop, I didn't know this until I did some studying up, was that his home and the lab was in the basement, was in Larchmont. It was only like 15 miles north of New York City, I guess. And a friend of mine who wrote for film magazines, I showed him some of the stuff I was doing. He says, you know what? I just interviewed Dick Smith. I'm going to give you his telephone number. I was like, oh. And I think it really took me a couple of weeks to build up the courage to call him, you know. And when I got him on the phone, he kept me on the phone, giving me information and where to get stuff. And so I ended up about 3 months later, he said, I need, you know, we're doing this big picture. You know, I have a crew of about four guys. I need an assistant, you know, and I can't afford to pay you much. And about $60 a day, which, you know, I was like, shit, $60 a day. So I ended up working on The Hunger, which was David Bowie, Catherine Deneuve. It was a Tony Scott film that was actually written by Whitney Strieber, you know, who did all the Communion books. And there were like six stages of old age for David Bowie. We had puppet heads and mummy suits and crumbling mummy effects. And it was the greatest picture I could have started on because it was everything you could think of, you know. And I got to watch these brilliant guys and watch Dick Smith at work. And then one day, they were going to shoot some stuff in Manhattan. And Dick was going to have John handle doing those makeups in town. And so John came up to Dick's house. That's the first time I met him. And, you know, if you get along with someone right away,
yeah,
share a similar sense of humor. You know, there's nothing more uncomfortable than working with someone who you say something funny and they just look at you like you're nuts.
It's the worst.
Yeah. But if you got somebody who's zeroing in on your sense of humor, you can have a lot of fun, you know? Mm-hmm. And John and I just clicked. And a few months after The Hunger, I guess he was going to do one of the Amityville movies. And they were shooting it in Mexico. And he called me up and said, will you be, you know, are you available? And I said, yeah. And he says, would you be willing to go to Mexico City? I'm like, hell yeah. That's the point in your life where just picking up and going someplace crazy is like, yeah, I'm all for that. Now I'm like, no, I don't want to go down the block.
I understand that feeling.
You know, so I started working with John on that, and we were together like 11, 12 years or something like that, I guess. And we had the best time. I mean, we were so similar and laughed at all the same stuff, and we became great partners. You know, we built a lab in Brooklyn, and then we came out to L.A. when Dick Tracy happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's the story. There's no way we should have got that job. I mean, really, we were just like young upstarts compared to Dick Smith said, well, you're never going to get Dick Tracy. You know, they're going to go to Rick Baker or Greg Canham or Rob Bottin or something like that. And there was a producer on Dick Tracy that we'd known from like four pictures back, John Landau.
Yes.
Landau went on to be James Cameron's guy on Avatar and Titanic. We were similar. And he recommended us to Warren Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
And then we knew Milena Cannonero, who was a costume designer from the Cotton Club. And she recommended us too. She knew us. So we were out in L.A. on some job, and John Landau calls us and says, can you meet with Warren? And of course we can. And we went up to his house on Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive is like, even now, I still think of it as like, you know, where the gods are.
Like Olympus.
Olympus. It's Olympus, you know, and you have all these gods, Hollywood gods, and actually rock and roll too, because, we go up to his house, and it was just like in The Incredibles, you know, where Mr. Incredible goes up to the house and there's a gate. She appears on the screen and she goes, my God, you've gotten so fat, you know, and it's just like that. And we waited in his screening room for about 20 minutes. And then he just like came bounding downstairs in a towel, soaking wet, like he just got out of the shower. And said, so what can we do? And I'm like, first of all, they rarely ever ask you that. You know, I said, well, what do you mean? You know, you mean the script? Yeah, the script. What can we do to make it better? Like, wow. But one of the things about Beatty was that he'll do like offbeat things to kind of throw you off.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, coming down the stairs in a towel wet was to throw us off balance.
So you think it was calculated?
I think it was calculated because he did other things like that. You know, when we got the job, it's funny, the production was getting us a house in like Van Nuys or something, which is like a ranch house type of thing. And well, you know, a PA's got pictures stapled into a thing. And I'm thinking it's pretty cool that they're looking for a place for us. I think that's already as good as it could get.
Right.
Voice comes behind us and says, oh no, you're not staying there. And turn around and it's Dick Silver's wife. Dick Silver was a production designer on the show. And this guy is like Hollywood royalty. I mean, Chinatown. You know, I mean,
wow.
The art department was all gods. You know, you had Harold Michelson, who, you know, worked for Robert Wise and Maurice Uperano, designed Gort and was Flying Saucer on the Day the Earth Stood Still. And, you know, God. So anyway, she says, oh, no. And she was quite a bit younger than Dick. And she had been a realist. She was a flower child, you know, from the 60s. And she had been doing real estate in the Hollywood Hills. And the next thing I know, John and I are like thrown in the back of her car. It's a Rolls Royce, no less. A hippie, you probably have a Rolls Royce. And took us to some houses. And it was this one house. It was like on the side of a cliff almost, just like they are on the side of a canyon.
Oh, yeah.
And it was three floors. And it was, and I'm thinking, Charmaine, you know, we can't afford this. And she says, believe me. She goes, if you and John and Kevin and Anthony split this house, you'll be able to afford it, no problem. And that's what we did. And we were living in, it was about a quarter of a mile from the Manson murders, for one thing.
From us, Spahn Ranch? Oh, from, not Spahn Ranch, the street, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, you know, you eventually find out, and there's actually another good documentary called Laurel Canyon, because we lived up off of Laurel Canyon. That was the center of rock and roll through the 60s and 70s, and even, I mean, I saw David Crosby, you know, up there one day. They all were living up there and intermingling with each other. You know, Joni Mitchell and, you know, it was crazy. The rock and roll history. But the beauty of the Hollywood Hills is that on one side, you've got Sunset Strip and you've got the comedy clubs and you've got rock and roll venues. And it's really alive and active. And down the other side, you've got the San Fernando Valley, which is more laid back and little shops and things like that. It was beautiful. You couldn't believe that you were in a city when you were up there. It was a perfect place for us.
What was it like actually working on Dick Tracy? Which projects were yours and which were John's?
Well, John, I mean, I will say at the outset that John was definitely the makeup genius between the two of us. I mean, he had been doing it for quite a while, you know. By the time this had happened, I was, a neophyte compared to him. You know, I saw him as my mentor like Dick Smith and leader. But we filled in gaps with each other, you know. I mean, we both put makeups on. We both sculpted. But really, we had like John and Kevin Haney and a few other people that we hired to do sculpting. It wasn't like one person sculpted everything. But really, the aesthetic of it was John and I, John being the point guy, you know. If John says this, then I say it twice as much.
Yes.
Well, but we were kind of a perfect storm together, you know. We could get stuff done, and we had a shorthand with each other. And if we were dealing with production, you know, sometimes, especially movies, you could get onto a project where they want to take advantage of you. You know, they're almost like predators. You know?
Really?
And they'll lie to you. And, you know, I mean, oh, yeah. Every show is different. Every show is a different ecosystem. You'll have fantastic situations where you don't have to worry about that. Everyone trusts each other. And I find mostly in TV. Well, but motion pictures are like more cutthroat. Unless it's a company that stays together from movie to movie to movie, that's different. But if it's just a picture that, you know, it's a totally different crew the next time, if there's something they got in trouble for and they could throw you under the bus to save their own skin, they'll do it.
They'll do it. Wow.
They'll do it. You know, so John and I were really great with dealing with, you know, predatory producers and directors and stuff like that. You know, we could play good cop, bad cop. You know, John was like 6'2 or 5'7. John was 6'2, good looking. Warren Beatty said, "Why do you look like an actor?"
You know? That's a hell of a thing for Warren Beatty to say.
I know. God damn you, Caglione. You know, as long as John was around, no girl was going to look at me. But I forgot where I was going with that.
Oh, which projects were yours and which were John's?
Yeah, oh, so, you know, yes, and that was it. Predatory directors and stuff like that. We could play good cop, bad cop. John would be the bad cop. John would be explosive, unpredictable, you know. And I would talk to them on the side and go, you know, he's a little upset. And don't worry, I'll talk to him and stuff like that. And we'd be playing them, you know.
Huh.
They were trying to play us. And they would try to split us up, too. But it was impossible. You couldn't split us up. So we were a perfect team. Like that, you know, makeup could be crazy. I, you know, the movie makeup era in my life was unpredictable and nutty. And when you're in your 20s and 30s and stuff, you're scrapping for a fight, you know?
Yeah.
Now I'm not so interested. I've done all the fighting I think I want to do, you know? But at that point, even though you might be scared because, you know, they're screwing around with you and, you know, you're having to deal with that. There was a certain thrill about it, you know. For instance, good cop, bad cop. Well, this wasn't exactly good cop, bad cop, but we were on a picture in North Carolina. We were in the woods. It was a Michael Mann movie. It was called Manhunter.
Sure.
And we had, the crew had been rained on for like, torrentially rained on and in the mud for like a week. And it was towards the end of the shoot. And we were not on the set. They called a meeting and called the crew in and said, Dino DeLaurentiis is threatening to pull the plug on the picture. And Michael Mann says, I need you guys to do me a favor. I need you to sign away your overtime. And it was a non-union picture. You could do that, you know. And they were all hungry because of non-union. And they're thinking, well, Michael Mann, you know, I mean, he's doing Miami Vice and he's a firebrand and he'll hire me next time, you know, if I do him this favor. So the whole crew signed away their overtime.
Wow.
Then we come back and we're standing in the woods one night in the cold, in the mud, in the rain. And some transpo guy, I guess, says, you know, you spend half your life trying to get into this business and you spend the other half trying to get out. And there was this groan from the whole crew. Because what Cookie's talking about. And one of the guys I was with, Neil March, says, well, think of the overtime we're making. And it was like every head turned to look at us like zombies who could smell brains. And so unbeknownst to us, we didn't know the crew gave away their overtime. The production called Caglione, who was back in New York, and said, the whole crew just, you know, signed away their overtime. we expect the makeup department to follow through and do the same thing. And John, in his best Michael Corleone, said, well, you know what? The makeup crew's on a plane coming home tonight. How do you like that? And they didn't like it one bit, but they knew it's not like a beauty makeup artist or a grip or something like that. You can replace them fairly easily. Not to take anything away from what they do, but when you're doing prosthetics, and you can't just bring somebody in overnight to do that job.
It's a different beast.
They were over barrel and they had to do it. But that's the kind of the thing about John, and it was something that you would never learn in Dick Smith's makeup handbook, was how to have balls. And he really, you know, was good at that. I remember we were on some picture and we had to go to Chicago and we talked to the unit production manager. And he says, my crew calls me King Kong. John says, well, King Kong, meet Mighty Joe Young.
That's great.
Hilarious. So yeah, he's my brother. You know, we had the best time you could imagine.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just great. It was a match.
That's wonderful, Doug. This next question, I'm just chomping at the bit to ask you. You mentioned this earlier. I know you and John, you won the Oscar for Best Makeup in 1991 for Dick Tracy. I've been watching that clip sort of ad nauseum in preparation for this. Like, oh, wow, I'm going to be talking to that guy. I'd love to know, what was the experience like getting on stage and accepting the Oscar with John?
Well, it was all a visual effect. We were in a separate room and he green screened us in. No, only kidding. You know, it's crazy because, well, first of all, we didn't think there was any competition there.
You think Edward Scissorhands got it, or?
No, we thought that Dick Tracy had everything beat by a mile, you know. But things can be political. You just never know. I mean, it's possible that there were people out there who said, oh, you came from New York. We got plenty of makeup artists in L.A. This isn't right. And not vote for us. You don't know. But it did go our way. You know, I remember on the show, every time we'd bring new makeup for Warren to see, he'd look at it and go, you guys are getting the statue, meaning the Academy Award. And when we did our bake-off at the Academy, we talk and explain what the work you did and stuff. As we're going out, Warren Beatty stepped out from behind a curtain near the exit. And he actually came down to show his support for us. It was like crazy. Warren Beatty. As a matter of fact, Warren Beatty, Dick Smith said we'd never get the job because they'd hire one of these other hotshots. And then when we got the job, and he was stunned, he said, well, you know, you got the job, but you'll never lift a brush on set. And scared us with stories about Howard Schmidt, who was a real tough cookie, who was the head of the union. And it just so happened that at that time, Warren hadn't made a decision yet whether the movie was going to be union or non-union. And, well, of course, the union wanted Dick Tracy to be theirs. And so Warren says, well, I think that we're going to go union. However, I want these two guys. And they were like, yes, whatever you'd like, Mr. Beatty. And the dreaded Howard Schmidt literally drove our applications out to our lab and handed them to us like this. It was amazing. That's Warren Beatty, the huge power that he had, you know. See, so what was the original question? Oh, yeah, going up to get the Oscar, what that's like. So there was tension. And it's funny, though. I mean, I've been to awards where people who didn't get it would cry. That was like mind-boggling to me. You're crying over this, you know. If we didn't get it, we would have just shrugged and said, well, there you go, just politics. When you get it, first, it was the Shrine Auditorium. It's a pretty big place. And, you know, then, I don't know, 30 million people or whatever would watch the Academy Awards. It was a Billy Crystal show, too, which was that era of his stuff was like very popular. And when you get called, I mean, you understand that you're almost like a bug under a microscope. And you are just a microbe when you consider that over here you've got Martin Scorsese sitting. And, you know, I mean, the people that you can't imagine seeing them in person, you know. When they do call your name, something weird happens. It's like reality goes. And it's like you're looking through a toilet paper tube. I think that your brain, to protect you, limits how much you can actually see. Because it doesn't want you to scream and tear your clothes off and run away. But yeah, I mean, we rehearsed our speech, you know. As a matter of fact, on my Vimeo page, we videotaped the rehearsals. And they're hilarious. I just loaded them up there about 8 months ago, 9 or 10 months ago. And it's on my Vimeo page, and it's a riot. So, I mean, going up and, you know, giving the speech was a piece of cake. And the thing is that you've got bright lights on you and stuff. So you can't really perceive just how many people are sitting out there. Although I have to say that by the time John and I, you know, did Dick Tracy, both of us had done many, many interviews for newspapers. And when we made the movie, they flew us all to Florida, Disney World, where at the MGM Disney studio there, they had an entire soundstage with like 100 tables, and each table had like 6 reporters around it. And you go from table to table to table and just talk about the show. And so we were, you know, speaking in front of a lot of people is like no big deal. I mean, especially now, man, I could get up and just give me a microphone. I could do an hour at a Star Trek convention. It's a piece of cake. And no trepidation or fear at all. It's like totally, when I was a kid, the whole idea of getting up and reading like your book report in high school was terrifying. You know, now it's like, give me that microphone.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. So, well, you know, the thing was, is that Ann Archer gave us our awards. She's a beautiful gal who we worked with on Fatal Attraction. And that's a story in itself. But after that, we had to go downstairs and go down this, you know, take pictures with the press and answer questions and things like that. And then you get, you return to your seat. And that meant that you go down, and there was a service corridor under the shrine. It was about a, must have been 1,000 feet long. She went 1,000 feet long. It looked like it to me. And we're walking and feeling pretty good about ourselves. And we're in tuxedos and we've got our Academy Awards. And about halfway down the corridor, this concrete corridor, you could see this guy kind of leaning against the, you know, the wall and looking kind of dejected. And it was, as we got closer to him, it was, oh God help me, Man Called Horse, Mutiny on the Bounty, Richard, took my memoir. Damn it.
Richard Harris.
Richard Harris. Thank you. It's Richard Harris, who's a big star. A big star. I mean, you know, Man Called Horse was amazing. And if you haven't seen Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando, then it's a must see. You have to see it. Marlon Brando's amazing in it. He's a foppish first officer. And he looks so, Richard Harris looks up and gives us a small smile. And the thing was that he had just lost. He was nominated. He didn't make it. He gets the award. And he smiles and he asks if he can, you know, hold the Oscar and hand it to him. He's like looking at it. He goes, well, I suppose this is probably my last chance to, you know, get one. And it was his last chance. Pretty sure. It was this really wonderful kind of bittersweet moment, you know, where you felt his frustration. And I mean, the guy has an amazing body of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, we made him feel good. We told him how much we loved his work. I was like, that, you know, and you feel fortunate to be even talking to him, you know. But that was a crazy experience. Very surreal. You know, when I said that, yeah, you know, some of the old Disney cartoons from the late 30s and stuff where they'd have Clark Gable and they're all like, you know, cartoon kind of characters of,
oh yeah,
Charlie Chaplin and blah, blah, you know, that's what it was like in a way, because some of these people, the camera loves their face, but in person, they don't look real.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really crazy. Huh. They almost look like...
like parodies of themselves?
Caricatures, almost. Huh. It's amazing how the camera will look at a face that in person is almost distracting or a caricature, but on the camera just loves that face, you know?
Huh, how incredible. Thanks, Doug. That's a really cool story. Do you remember what you did the rest of the night? Celebrated, I assume?
Well, we went to the governor's ball afterwards, but there were parties all over town. You know, Spago's and, you know, the thing was that we were working on a picture called For the Boys with Bette Midler and Jimmy Caan.
Mm-hmm.
And our call was like 2 a.m. Doesn't matter that you went to the Academy.
The next day.
That morning.
Wow.
Doesn't matter. We got to go to the Governor's Ball, but that was it. We had to go right to bed and get there while it was still dark. And, you know, there's nothing quite like arriving on a movie location or in the early, early, wee small hours in the morning, because there's this a wonderful environment. You could smell the bacon cooking in the craft service truck, and generators are starting up, and people are coming, you know, PAs are coming to ask you if you want, you need your coffee, and, you know, that it kind of puts you into an alpha state that kind of gets you ready for war, you know? Yeah, I remember we got to the state, we got to the studio, and we're passing by Jimmy Caan's trailer, and the window slams open. I mean, he was crazy. And he sticks his head out and he goes, Jesus Christ, they're going to be impossible now. And slams the window. He was a character.
Yeah, what was it like working with him? That was actually one of my questions.
Yeah, he was crazy. I mean, we loved him. You know, at his height, you could be, you know, rowdy, smart mouth, flirt with the girls and stuff. And it was like, you know, no one thought much of it. Today, you could get in a lot of trouble. You know, we had a makeup artist on the show, who Jimmy Caan sitting there trying to eat his lunch, and he's reading a script, and she's got a motor mouth and she can't shut up.
Huh.
And he freaks out, throws the whole tray against the wall like Oscar Madison, and tells her to shut the f*** up. Can you shut the f*** up? And You can't do that today, boy. Woo!
No.
Wow. And some serious trouble. I have to say that it's kind of a shame in a way. Within reason, if you're not physically hurting someone or look, because he yelled at you, if that psychologically hurt you, I think you're in the wrong business. But, you know, as long as you're not, you know, doing some of the bad stuff that we hear about.
Right, right.
If you want to be a wiseacre and give someone a hard time, as long as it's not that tough, to have everybody on their very best behavior all the time, which is nothing wrong with, because that's how aircraft carriers and stuff work. You know, they don't fight with each other on the bridge.
Right. Well, I would imagine that could be quite detrimental in a creative environment because you're trying to, well, create things. And sometimes to get to the right ideas, you got to misbehave somewhat, I imagine.
I don't remember what show it was. There was a writer's room on a comedy show, I think was dominated by guys. And there was a female assistant, a writer's assistant. And those meetings can get rowdy and crazy and calling each other names. And, you know, and years later, she sued him. You know, that it was bad for her, you know, psyche, that she would have to put up with it. Now, a few years back, there was a thing with some woman was suing Dustin Hoffman.
Right.
That years earlier, she had been a PA or something, and she came to ask him what his breakfast was. And I think he said, a soft-boiled clitoris. Now, I worked with Dustin.
Yes.
Worked with Dustin. He's just a funny, crazy, loves a dirty joke. You know, let him go. Let him make his dirty joke.
Look, yeah.
Upset you so much, you are definitely in the wrong business. It's a hard business. How are you going to deal with when things really go wrong?
Right. When someone actually meets, but how are you going to deal with the predatory producer who's trying
to
bend you over the barrel?
But we found, you know, sometimes it could be like a pirate ship, you know, and we found that fun, you know. I mean, I want to hear what he's going to say. Don't make him, you know, watch his mouth.
Just yes. Talk.
If you're really going after somebody and making their life impossible, like Marlon Brando did with his director who was in the island of Dr. Moreau or whatever. Have you seen that documentary? Oh, my God. He drove that guy crazy. He drove him to a nervous breakdown practically. That is not right.
And countering on that, I also think of Shelley. I always get the Long and the Duvall mixed up. But Shelley on The Shining. Stanley Kubrick, you know, supposedly drove her to basically a mental breakdown.
Well, I heard that about Hitchcock on The Birds with Tippi Hedren.
Yeah, yeah. It's a weird balance because on the one hand, you want to treat people well. On the other hand, real life is real life.
They're revved up sometime if they're doing a performance.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there are actors who will say he pushed me to the breaking point, but it added to, like, for instance, some famous in The Exorcist.
Mm.
There was, you know, the priest that goes out the window and down the stairs, boom, 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 and he's all. There was the other priest who was his friend who kind of had a plucky sense of humor and was playing the piano and singing and all that stuff. At the scene where his friend goes down the stairs and is at the bottom of the stairs and everyone's running and they're trying to get an ambulance and he's a mess. And this priest goes to give him absolution, his friend.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it is. And he wasn't an actor. He was a real priest who that when they were researching the film, they met him and they liked him and they wanted to use him.
Oh.
And here's the scene that is really emotional and tears and stuff like that and shaking voice. He couldn't do it. Friedkin slugged him, smacked him across the face as hard as he could.
Wow.
And he gave the performance of his life. Yeah. Another good example, this isn't abusing anyone. But, oh, yeah. I mean, the same thing. What's the name of played the mob on The Exorcist? There's a scene where Linda Blair whacks her across the face and she goes flying across the room and he had a cable attached to her with a harness. With a ratchet set up to yank her back. And they yanked her. She hit the wall and she told Friedkin, she said, can you have them, you know, back off it a little bit? This is on the disc where they talk about the picture. Can they back? Because that really hurt. And someone else on stage heard Friedkin tell the effects guy ratcheted it up a little more to take by surprise. But that's not right. But it didn't get. And I think that she, you know, fractured a rib or something from it, you know. There are directors who will do things like that. Now, for instance, Marlon Brando on The Godfather, and Dick Smith told me about this, because Dick did the makeup on The Godfather. The singer who comes in and says, Godfather, I need this, I want to do the picture, but they won't let me do it, you know, and he's being a whiny baby. And he's actually, I can't remember the name of the crooner, but he's real. He's a real crooner, not an actor. And Brando, watch the thing. Brando jumps up out of his chair, smacks him across the face and says, you better act like a man. That's not the script. Watch the crooner guy, he's trying to keep from laughing. He's doing everything he can to keep from cracking up. And it's because it was totally unpredictable.
Wow.
That he took the guy by surprise to get a certain reaction out of him, you know? Sometimes you have to do that.
Sure.
And if you do it within reason, it's okay. You know that on The Exorcist, when someone would be startled, something happened, they looked startled, like it happened instantly. They had an effects guy behind the wall. The actor doesn't know it. With a shotgun, with a blank shotgun shell in it. And just fired it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So stuff like that to get, you know, real honest reactions from some people. Sometimes, especially after you've done it, you know, 40 times, it's starting to look stale and like you're acting.
Just a different time, I guess, huh?
I'm sure there's still some of that because, look, people want to do what the director wants. And if the director does something crazy like that, a lot of them are going to say, hey, thanks for doing that because I brought something out in my performance I couldn't get together, you know?
Interesting.
It's hard to know, you know, where to draw the line. I think a good person knows where.
Yeah.
You ratchet somebody against the wall and amp it up when they ask you to take it down a little bit. That's not quite.
Maybe we draw the line somewhere after the blank shotgun shell, but somewhere before the ratcheting.
Yeah, that sounds fair.
So I'd love to know, Doug, when I was doing my research here, I understand that you worked with Meryl Streep.
Yeah. It was a picture called Heartburn, and it had Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, the shot in Manhattan.
Was that the one that was Kevin Spacey's first movie?
Well, I wasn't on stage every day. He may have been on it. I don't know.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
But it was Nicholson and Meryl Streep, and it's like, oh my God, these are titans, you know?
Right.
That was the first time we met Nicholson. Yeah, we came in the makeup room, and he was like in pajamas, like lounging in a barber chair, and his hair all tousled, you know? But you see, the beautiful thing, it wasn't heavy-duty makeup work. She had to be pregnant. So we made pregnant bellies for her. She came out, and, you know, we did a life cast of her and made pregnant bellies. But there's a scene where there's like, Meryl catches Jack Nicholson in bed with some woman who, through cut, she's becoming the Wicked Witch of the West. And so she has to look like Margaret Hamilton. And they had an outfit for her that looked like Margaret Hamilton. And they actually did this thing where they had a hole in the floor with a lift. So she would go down and the whole dress would, you know, and then the hat had a stick in it. You pull the stick out and the hat would go flat.
Oh,
it was great. And Nicholson ad-libs, honey, I can explain everything. I don't know that they use that. So now, of course, to work with those two was amazing enough. But the director was Mike Nichols. You know who Mike Nichols is?
The great Mike Nichols.
Great Mike Nichols.
Yes.
Of course, the thing was that it's beautiful now because if I had to meet an actor, I could go on the internet and find every little thing about them, you know. And so I knew something about Mike Nichols, but it wasn't even like I could go online and watch their movies, you know. Later on, I found out, you know, I mean, that he had a partner and they did stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite movies, Catch 22, was Mike Nichols. Oh, like The Graduate.
I was going to say Charlie Wilson's War sometime later. The Birdcage, one of my favorite movies. I mean, the
amazing.
List goes on. I think he won like 5 Oscars, I think.
I'll tell you a story. I was working at Dick Smith's. I think it was before I worked at Mike Nichols. He comes in with a full page, like, you know, it's funny what's happened to magazines. The large Life magazines used to be one of the most important, you know, magazines in the country. You know, and it was a full page, beautiful shot of Mike Nichols portrait. And Smith comes in and says, tell me what's wrong with this guy. And I look at him, I can't tell. And he says, Mike Nichols has alopecia. That means he's got no eyebrows. And he's got no hair on his head. Totally bald. And I wouldn't have known. But if you're a guy like him, you could afford to get the very best hair pieces made, the very best wigs. And Mike actually had a wig for every week. That was a little longer, like it was growing. Yeah.
Wow.
But he was a great guy. I mean, you know, we got to know him. It was one of the first times, you know, Jerry Lewis invented the video assist. Did you know that?
I did know that. I think it was on, what was his bellboy, Cinderfella.
Yeah. Yeah. People don't realize, see, I'm going off the beaten path here. People don't realize what an important guy like Lucy and Desi were on I Love Lucy, how they transformed how television's made.
Right.
You know, books, I talked about the making of Star Trek, influential books. In 1971, I think, in the school library, I found The Complete Filmmaker by Jerry Lewis.
Hmm.
And it was his UCLA class. He did classes at UCLA where he got guys like Spielberg in it and John Landis. And, you know, basically, he didn't write the book. They took his classes and they, you know, they composited it into a book, you know.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that that guy did was like, he was way ahead of his time.
I'm still waiting for that clown concentration camp movie. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
The one, I forget what it was called, but he had it locked away, I think.
Yeah, he won't show it.
Huh. It's a shame.
It's a shame. You know, it really is a shame. There's another documentary, I think it's on Prime, called A Method to His Madness, Jerry Lewis.
I saw it. Yeah, that's how I knew about the VA.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it starts with the comedy, and then it goes, there's the Dean and Jerry era, which Cagney and I always considered ourselves the Martin and Lewis of makeup. Because we even had a breakup like they did and then come back together and be friends again. It was just like it. It was crazy.
That's awesome.
But yeah, that's one to watch. Then it goes into when he split with Dean and he was doing movies by himself. You saw it. You know, he became interested in every department, kind of like I did. Interested in every department, learning what everyone's job was, you know.
He was like a Swiss Army knife. He just wanted to be able to do every job. And he could do it, too. I mean, The Nutty Professor was everything. He wrote it. He directed it. He starred in it, certainly, you know.
Oh, some of those scripts he wrote in 6 days.
Yeah. Yep.
He had that deal with Paramount, which, if you want to see the Paramount backlot, then watch The Errand Boy. It's all over the Paramount backlot. And, you know, him driving carts through stages and, you know. He had a deal with Paramount where he could use the facilities, all this stuff, and he would put some of his own money in. So it would be cheap for them. But he would say, but I own the negative. And so that means every Jerry Lewis movie, the Jerry Lewis family is still collecting on it, not Paramount.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing.
It is. That's awesome. I could go on. You get me on movies, it's kind of like catnip to me. I can just go on. Maybe a couple questions left, Doug, if that's all right. I know we're over. I have time a little bit. I appreciate it, man. So aside from winning the Oscar, which I imagine would be your answer, is there a particular experience from your career that especially stands out for you?
Well, you know, it's like I'm in the middle of writing my own memoir, and there's so many crazy things that have happened. I like whip through it and go, what? I mean, you know, yes, the Academy Award is, you know, fantastic. You know, we won a couple of Emmys for Battlestar Galactica for visual effects. That's really great, too. You know, it's great to get more awards for something totally different. You know, so that's exciting. And then on the other hand, though, well, I've designed a couple of Enterprises for Star Trek, actual Enterprises. I mean, if you're a Star Trek geek or a science fiction geek, to design an Enterprise is like, let's see, Academy Award, design an Enterprise. Academy Award, design an Enterprise. What am I going to do? You know, so, I mean, that's like amazing. I've been really, you know, fortunate that I actually got into the business, crazy enough as it is. Sometimes I think that I must be on the side of the road after an accident bleeding out, and I'm having like a hallucination where life goes just the way I want it to. Originally, as a kid, I wanted to be a comic book artist. All I could say is, thank God I didn't do that. You know, I mean, I love Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and all those people, you know, and I draw pretty well, and that's what I thought I wanted to do. But I found, you know, you'll find out that comic book artists don't get rich. Unless you sell your property somehow to Hollywood, you know, like Ninja Turtles or something like that.
Right.
But otherwise, it's really, unless you're Jack Kirby, who's working at a company and can do 4 books a month, well, one person is trying desperately to finish 1 book in a month.
Volume.
Yeah, volume. So thank God I didn't do that. But yeah, I mean, just working in the beginning, just getting to work on a picture is like a pinnacle for you. And then there's like another pinnacle.
I understand that. You're just looking for a better quality of problem. Right. It begins where I just want the freaking job. Then you get the job and then, you know, you have an issue with whatever it is. You know, I have too many jobs. I have to decide which one I want. You're just looking for a better quality of problem in life.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes, and talk about switching to a different thing, like, you know, go to makeup to art department, is there's a certain point where, like, when I'd been doing makeup for like 13 years or something like that and win an Academy Award, you're at a position where you're expected to know everything now. He must know everything about it. And if you don't, it's like, what's wrong with him? How come he doesn't? I don't want that. I demand the right to be stupid. If I go to the art department, I'm going to spend at least a year where I don't know what the hell I'm doing. No one can blame me. He should know. He doesn't know, you know? So you get to a certain point where that becomes real easy.
Interesting.
I mean, like, graphics was very easy for me compared to designing a ship. Design a ship on Star Trek, they're pixel every little thing you do because it's the ship, you know. But But if you're doing graphics, control consoles, they're going to look at it a little bit, but they don't pixel. So it was like, I hadn't been on Star Trek for a few years, and Star Trek Picard, a guy I became friends with on my Facebook page, Dave Blass, you know, wanted to talk Star Trek and stuff like that, was chatting. And then one day he tells me he's a production designer on Picard.
Oh, cool.
I said, I had no idea. And he says, you know, he asked me to come onto the show because he wanted people who had been on the show before. They don't do that much on the new shows. They want someone who doesn't know anything about Star Trek because they want the production designer. He doesn't want to be told that he's doing something wrong. Well, according to this episode, this should be like that. He don't want to hear that. So they want someone who doesn't know that well so they can put their own mark on it. I get that. I actually get that. But the thing about Dave was that he was a Star Trek geek as a kid, and he showed me a picture of himself at about the age of 12 in a motion picture era uniform. And I was like, well, it just shows in the right hands. To get someone, and the producer was also an assistant, a writer's assistant, when we were doing like Voyager and Enterprise. And he used to hang out in the art department. Now he's the showrunner. And their attitude, because they love Star Trek, was, I want people to speak the language now. And things like, well, we'll get Michael Kuda, we'll get Doug, you know, we already have John Eaves. To work on Star Trek in a situation like that is really terrific. You know, I don't want to be mercenary or anything, but if they wanted to hire me and I thought the show was not following continuity, I'd still take the job. I have to do the best I can because I need to eat.
Yeah. Seems fair to me. Doug Drexler, thank you so much again, man. This was a real honor. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's an honor for me.
Doug, you take care.
Hey, you have a great day, and thanks again.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.